We are continuing in the class series of classes about the Ten Commandments. As we've talked, this is a follow-up to the movie I Am. Commandment today that we're going to be looking at and study is Thou Shalt Not Kill. Not murder, Exodus 1:13. And, you know, you're going to hear, and I think the commentary does a pretty nice job of framing some of the issues, but one of the things that when we introduce the topic of you know, thou shalt not murder, you know, when we think about the Ten Commandments, you know, we've talked many times that the Ten Commandments themselves really kind of, you know, people have used them over the course of time to kind of do this checklist of yep, nope, nope, yep, and kind of going down that list in terms of our own personal actions and behaviors, you know. By and large, you know, if you take murdering someone at face value in terms of causing them to cease to exist, kill their heart, they die physically, most of us, you know, probably can check that one off and say, no, I'm not guilty of that one. Now, we might be guilty of the other nine, you know, in our minds, whatever, but that one seemed to be pretty easy. And I think that actually that what we're going to find is that in the New Testament, we're going to look at some verses there, that Jesus and even John, in the book of 1 John, kind of reframes this and kind of challenges us to think about, you know, murdering differently, and really begins to delve and dive into our own hearts. What's the intent of our hearts? What's our attitude towards others? And how many times have you heard somebody say, boy, I was in a conversation with somebody, or I overheard a conversation, and somebody was saying, "Boy, he was just murdering so and so." You know, how many of you have heard the term? You know, boy, that was a character assassination. We even in our own language have in America have embraced some of these terms that about murder and assassination, things that we take that are literal and have applied them to our attitudes, our choices, our actions, and our reactions to individuals and of themselves. And frankly, that's really at the core of what Jesus and John get to. And you know, Christ is not reframing the Ten Commandments. He is bringing some clarity. In fact, he's also what he is doing is basically saying and showing how the law, or the keepers of the law, so to speak, the Levitical tribe, the priests, the religious engine of the world at that time, how they were basically taking it and twisting around, you know, the interpretation of the Ten Commandments to fit their needs. One, either to justify them lashing out at somebody, character assassination, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. In fact, in 1 John, I think it is, no, it's in John, or in Matthew, when we look at it. But it also talks about how really the whole intent there was to try and justify the rabbis that embraced an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, to rationalize why it was okay for them to basically characterize or cast somebody in the poor light or to lash out at them. So that's kind of the context of which we're going to have a little bit more discussion on today. What do you think is worse, a guilty person being set free or an innocent person being put away? What do you think is worse, a guilty person being set free or an innocent person being put away?
Depends on who it is.
An innocent person being put away, probably.
Person, what that?
An innocent person being put away.
But if you're letting out Charles Manson,
yeah,
you know.
What is that?
I understand the point, but to let some criminals go, you are basically killing people. I mean, you know they're going to reoffend.
Yeah.
So to commit a crime against one person, I mean, it's a quandary question that I am thankful I don't have to answer, but
Although, in one sense, we all kind of participate in
we
that
do.
Because that's, you know, whether or not it's in the legal court that where it comes out. I mean, you know, today, 20 years down the road, you know, now we have new technology with DNA, and so all of a sudden, you know, we're retrying and looking at the facts around the case, and we're finding that there's some people who were put in jail that have been held accountable for, in some cases, were even killed, from a capital punishment standpoint of view, or have spent their life in prison, and we hear that when they get let out because the facts didn't prove the fact that they weren't guilty. The point is, I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer. I think all of us probably have a little different view through that lens. And we can even see that in our pastor and his wife,
we can't even agree.
One side or the other. And quite frankly, you know, it seemed like that they were fairly passionate about the position that they initially took. But when you start asking that question and apply it to our attitudes and our actions and our reactions, you know, how we treat other individuals, how we approach them, how we in our own mind become judge and jury, and how we treat them, in essence, you know, even give them capital punishments. Now you start standing back and you start reframing that whole question about, you know, what's worse? And those two questions, when you take it away from the literalness of someone being killed or being held accountable for it, it causes us to have to look inward a little bit differently. And it's easy for us to, you know, from the third party out, and when you're not directly involved, to be very objective. But it's not quite as easy when all of a sudden we're being asked to look inwardly at our own heart and our own intent and how we are approaching, how we are responding to others. And remember, as we've said many times, our actions as professed Christians are being looked at by other people. Any other thoughts or comments before we watch the video?
Previously on the 10.
Doctor, I have metastasized pancreatic cancer. I'll be dead in 2 months.
I'm afraid I don't follow.
You froze a dog and a pig and brought them back to life. I am going to pay you a fortune to freeze me.
The people of L.A. love nothing like the present. They live for the moment. No future, no past. But the past has a way of catching up with us no matter how fast we live. It is relentless.
Manifestation of my subconscious has transferred into hallucination.
Right now, they're putting it all together. Who did I call? Where did I go?
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Jake Russell, Los Angeles Police Department. Do you own this home?
No.
Do you work here?
Yes.
Do you mind if I come in?
No. You've got 90 seconds. Don't sit. You're wasting time, Detective. Down to 83 seconds.
Angelica Vita went missing 1 year ago and hasn't been heard from since.
I have a TV. Tell me what I don't know.
2 weeks prior to her disappearance, she made a series of phone calls to a Dr. Richard Ortiz.
She had cancer. People with cancer call doctors.
Dr. Ortiz is not an oncologist. He's a cryogenics expert. 2 days before he arrived, she filed 10 different trusts in the Cook Islands, all funded with exactly the same amount of money, $24.2 million. The contents of the trust are sealed, but we do know that they all have the same executor, Petros Dimitrios. He's a Greek national, longtime confidant. Dimitrios personally runs 7 of her largest companies, mainly in tourism, hotels, and shipping. 3 days after her disappearance, one of these trusts transferred $1 million to a company in Switzerland known as Endless Horizon. That company then transferred $1 million to a company in Hong Kong known as Infinity. Infinity has made payments to only one person since its founding 1 year ago. Ortiz.
Where's the crime?
The trusts have also been making payments to a factory in La Paz, Mexico.
Well, is Ortiz on the payroll?
No.
Well, your 90 seconds is up, Detective.
Angelica Vita had cancer and didn't want to die, so she hired Ortiz to freeze her.
Is this your way of asking for a transfer to missing persons? Because that is not what we do here.
No, ma'am.
Well, then stop wasting your time and mine. Still haven't figured it out. Or maybe you do now. That's it, isn't it? That deep churn in your soul. You know you have a choice to make. It's you, or it's me. If you want them to leave you alone, the money has to stop flowing.
Freezing a living human being is illegal.
Come on, Doctor. Who are you kidding? You froze those human cells for a reason. Because you knew that it would work. Now someone is going to go down in history as the person who discovered the secret to everlasting life. And you want that person to be you.
When did the harbor master report it into La Paz?
Wednesday. Same trip 26 times this year.
Wait, how many times?
26.
Where's it moored now?
Marina del Rey.
When does it leave?
I don't know. You better get down here.
Mexico.
It's a little far for our jurisdiction, don't you think?
It's all right here. The yacht's in her name, and he's living on it. Look at the phone records. They never even spoke until a month before her disappearance. Now he's living on her yacht.
Well, people meet people, Detective. There's not a law against having a boyfriend.
Come on, he's been down to her factory every 2 weeks like clockwork since she disappeared. That's not a boyfriend. That's a cryogenics doctor making sure that his high-paying client stays nice and frozen. Look at the most recent phone records. Now he's talking to the brother.
She is not dead. So, she's frozen. That is not a homicide.
Look, if we can prove that Ordis is taking money from one of Vita's companies, then we got a conspiracy to defraud. We get Ordis, we find Angelica. That's huge. Just need a search warrant. If I'm wrong, and this thing goes south, then you can hang me out to dry. But if I'm right, then you look good. This whole department looks good. This could be huge for all of us.
We'll take it to the DA's office.
Perfect.
Let's do it.
Do not let me down, Detective.
Can't help you.
Well, I was afraid you were going to say that. Now, I don't think I have to tell you what those pictures are. I think you already know. You actually told her she'd only be gone for a second. Did you kind of know your body, Gretchen?
Tough stuff. But you know, of all the commandments, this was the one I always felt like I was pretty good on. You know, I've never killed anybody. I don't plan on killing anybody. I don't want to kill anybody. So, you know, I figured we could just say check, move on. But then there's the Sermon on the Mount. It's probably Jesus' most famous public address, and in it, he takes on the sixth commandment. He says, if you've been angry, if you have cursed anybody, if you've even called anybody a bad name, you deserve judgment too. Well, I mean, if you've ever watched me play sports or watched me watch sports or even the news or even in traffic, you know I've violated all three of those. But how can you lump me in with a killer? I really struggled with that for a really long time until very, very recently when I was talking with a friend of mine, and he was telling me about a friend of his who'd done him wrong and had really violated his trust, and he says to me, "That guy's dead to me." And I thought, yeah, should be. Deserves it. But then I thought about exactly what we were saying. You know, we weren't talking about literally killing a person, but we were talking about killing a relationship. We were talking about killing a person's reputation. You know, I think that's exactly why Jesus expanded the sixth commandment. You see, murder and all of its angry cousins, they don't just stop someone else's beating heart. They destroy our own. In the movie, Dr. Ortis was a killer. He accidentally killed a woman in an experiment. And that shame allowed him to be blackmailed by Angelica into freezing her. He was never caught. But what happened to his heart? The guilt and the pain of knowing what he had done eventually destroyed him to the point that he killed himself. And even before that, he was just a shell of a man. See, Jesus isn't calling us out to judge us or to ridicule us. He's trying to protect us from ourselves. You know, when we lash out or when we isolate in anger, that venom just boomerangs right back into our own lives. And it destroys us from within. With the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus changes the way we look at murder. It's not just stopping a heart. It's breaking one, too.
We touched on it briefly, but his self-reflection of saying, you know, when he read through the Ten Commandments, he said, how can you lump me in with a killer? And yet, you know, the term about their, we murder people, tying it to the angry cousin, the analogy that was brought forth there, all the time. That person's dead to me. It's like they don't even exist because of what they did to me. Have any of us here ever been guilty of killing a relationship? Killing a reputation? Well, killing the relationship one's pretty easy for me. Unfortunately, I have. Killing a reputation, I probably have, but I can't think of an example. But oftentimes, we kill relationships and reputations, and we don't even know it, by things that we say about somebody that may or may not be true, that influences how other people view the target of our venom. And I really liked what he said about, you know, Christ is really trying to protect us from ourselves. In the movie, Dr. Ortis, what was it that was really eating him up? I mean, was his intent to kill that person? What was the pictures that were in there? For those of you who may not have seen the entire story, what it was is that he was actually, you know, trying to test some of his cryogenic theories, and was paying some, who ultimately, which you will see in subsequent snippets, is the detective who was kind of pounding his hand at the end. It was his wife whose pictures were shown there. And they had been newly married. And as a result of her wanting to get some money so that they could enjoy something that they'd wanted to do, she died. So he obviously is harboring a lot. Was it satisfying to him that Dr. Orris was dead at the end? He thought he got away easy. He didn't get to do it. He didn't get to do it, yeah. What does that say about his heart?
Well, obviously he was struggling.
He was being consumed by his own anger that he couldn't see beyond the trees. He was so consumed by that that everything he did in his job, going to his boss, was focused on one thing, was getting revenge. He was looking for personal retaliation, which a lot of people do with an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. They think that that's, you know, justification for personal retaliation. Now, Dr. Ortis, he was being consumed by something different, wasn't he? Equally as painful, but he knew what he had done. Now, that wasn't his intent when he started out, but he allowed himself, because of a choice, because of a decision that he made and a consequence that happened that he never took accountability for. But what ultimately ended up happening was that he began to try, he was blackmailed, wasn't he? Because of the things that he had done, that he was trying, he was being consumed by his guilt, and somebody else used that to their benefit for their own, what they perceived was their own personal gain. Are we guilty of that at all today? These are pretty extreme results, but I would submit to you that we are pretty guilty of these things. Look with me at Matthew 5, 21 and 22. It's part of the Sermon on the Mount. It says, "You have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I," and who's the I here? It's Christ. "But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment, and whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council, but whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire." Does anybody know what raca is? What it means? It means foolish. Moral unworthiness, worthlessness. Vain fellow. Stupid. Yeah. In that definition, shall be in danger of the council. And the council then was the Sanhedrin court. So that was a civil type of a situation that he was talking about. You know, you can, with your words and your actions, you can put yourself in a position when you attack somebody, when you attack their character, or they, you know, you can find yourself and you can take it into civil court. But what's the second part there? "But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire." Any sense of what Christ was saying there? Now visually, as you're thinking about that, visually the hellfire, the valley again, it's outside Jerusalem there, it was basically the garbage dump, and there was fires that continually burned. And it's the metaphor, the example that people knew in terms of, I think, literal hell. But that was the visual of what those people understood that hellfire to be. It was not a place that anybody desired to go out into to the city dump and experience those fires.
Concept that you're basically saying the person has no value, devaluing them.
That's a little different than a civil. That's a heart of hatred. And I want you to keep that thought in your mind.
"For this is the message that ye heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of that wicked one, and slew his brother. And wherefore slew he him? Because his own works were evil, and his brother's righteous. Marvel not, my brethren, if the world hate you. We know that we have passed from death unto life, because we love the brethren. He that loveth not his brother abideth in death. Whosoever hateth his brother is a murderer, and ye know that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him. Hereby perceive we the love of God, because he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoso hath this world's good, and seeth his brother have need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him? My little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. And hereby we know that we are of the truth, and shall assure our hearts before him. For if our heart condemn us, God is greater than our heart, and knoweth all things. Beloved, if our heart condemn us not, then have we confidence toward God. And whatsoever we ask, we receive of him, because we keep his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. And this is his commandment, that we should believe on the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another, as he gave us commandment. And he that keepeth his commandments dwelleth in him, and he in him. And hereby we know that he abideth in us by the Spirit which he hath given us.
What relevance does that have back to what Jesus said in Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount? What relevance does this have as it relates to the sixth commandment? So what does that have to do with murder?
Murder doesn't come because I accidentally slipped and cut somebody. Okay. I mean, murder comes from how we feel in our heart. He uses the example of Cain.
I like the fact that he ties it back to Cain. And what he really talked about was is that you know, what led to Cain killing Abel was he was consumed by his anger because he felt God was showing preferential treatment to Abel. He didn't focus on his own accountability. He didn't focus on what it is that I needed to do or what didn't I do to be acceptable in God's sight. He focused his energy on somebody. In this particular case, it was his brother. It was his own flesh and blood. The jealousy was so and such that he couldn't see clearly.
And what's interesting for Cain is the reason he was so upset with his brother
had to do with Cain's relationship with God. I mean, he was fine with his brother until there was a problem with him and God, and then he lashed out against his brother.
Yeah. That's an interesting statement. You'll hear that. I think that is interesting.
I think that's the point he's trying to make later, that we can't say we love God and then hate our brother.
I like, if you look down, verse 20, it says, "For if our heart condemn us, God is greater than our heart and knoweth all things." Beloved, if our heart condemn us not, then we have confidence towards God. And whosoever we ask, and whatsoever we ask, we receive of him, but because we keep his commandments and do these things that are pleasing in his sight. You know, God will answer our prayers, but we have to approach him with what kind of a heart? A right heart. This talks about, you know, if our heart is not condemning us. In other words, what does that mean? Our heart's not condemning us. Conviction. Absolutely. How many of you have done something that would be considered not showing respect to somebody that could be considered as kind of trying to character assassination? And then thought better of it, and you just, your stomach was churning. And you said, "Did I really do that? Really?" I can remember, you know, and many of you have heard me tell this story before, but, you know, during the data theft that goes back in my job and working late, And you know, I was so frustrated, and that my frustration was towards some of my coworkers, and I wasn't even conscious of it. I mean, I was conscious of what I had said, but I wasn't conscious of what the impact on what I said was. And I didn't ask myself, and I didn't filter it, and I didn't say, what am I hoping to accomplish? Trying to catch that reaction, and ask myself, why am I going to say what I'm going to say? What do I hope to accomplish with it? And I got to tell you, I didn't even think about it until the next morning. It never crossed my mind that I crossed a line in that relationship. Till I had a meeting with that person again, and they came in and said, if you treat me like you did last night, she says, we're not going to have this meeting. Wow, kind of like somebody took their hand and just slapped me across the face. Then they went on to say, and two of our other colleagues overheard it, and they couldn't believe
it. That was kind of tough to hear. But the reality was, what I was beginning to do at that point, that I was consumed by, my own guilt. You know, there's no question that I had not treated these individuals. I had not treated the individual that I had said it to with respect. But it was overheard and had a cascading effect to others. That, frankly, was killing my reputation, if you want to be selfish about it. But at that point, was my relationship with God whole? If I'd have gone to him, boy, I need all this, I need your help, I need to do this, and yet I was not going to acknowledge or accept the fact that my own heart was calling me to attention, my own conscience. And when our heart is a saved individual is being called to attention and guilt is there, what else is happening? Where's that conviction come from? The Holy Spirit. So if we're unwilling to address and acknowledge that guilt that we're feeling because of how we conducted ourselves in a relationship, how can our relationship with God be good? How can we expect God to bless us if we're unwilling to take accountability for our own choices and our own actions towards others? I could have done what I probably have been guilty of when I was younger, and probably still do. But in this particular example, as soon as it was brought to my attention, I said, you're right. I was wrong. And what's so fascinating about it is, human nature being what it is, at the point that I said I was sorry, made no excuses for it. Because remember, what do most of us do? What does human nature do when somebody confronts you that you've wronged them?
Excuse our behavior or blame somebody
else. Yeah, excuse our behavior or blame somebody else. Or both. Or both, yeah.
That's the ultimate, I guess.
Yeah.
Do both of them.
Yeah. Now, had I said, I was just under a lot of stress and I'm sorry. Now, is that really acknowledging and accepting accountability? No, because we did exactly what Brother Harlan said, is we trying to rationalize our behavior. Acknowledge that maybe it crossed a line, but there really is no acknowledgement there.
But it also says you're not then even responsible for your circumstances. Right. And you can expect me to do it again if something out of the extraordinary or something happens to me, I get stressed again, you
right.
can expect this behavior again.
Right.
And, I mean, it's basically just saying I'm not in control of who I am. Mm-hmm.
That's such a fascinating statement. Could you say it one more time?
I'm not in control of who I am.
I'm not in control of who I am. Now, how many of us are willing to raise your hand now and say that you think that that's a true statement, that we are not in control of who we are?
Probably you.
used that excuse before.
It's a different question, isn't it? Yeah, when somebody takes and casts it that way, no. I'm in control of who I am. I make my own choices. Every one of us have probably used that line sometime. I control that. I make my own choices. But yet, when it crosses over the other line and somebody calls us on those choices and we decide that we don't want to take any accountability or we don't want to have any accountability with it because we want to rationalize, we want to defend, one of those two statements has been wrong. One of those two statements has been wrong. So how have you... Well, let me finish, because most of you heard the story, some of you may haven't. What I said to the individual at that point was, I stopped, and I says, you're right. I was wrong. And do any of you remember what the statement back to me was? Their response back to me, this one individual's response back to me was, it's okay. You know, you are under a lot of stress. You know, you, that's not who you are. I've known you for 20 years. In essence, what were they doing? What's that? They were forgiving me, but what else were they doing? How could I have interpreted that? I could have interpreted it as, oh, okay, I just got away with it. All I had to do was say, I'm sorry.
Is that she? Is that doing a lot? The reality was that she was beginning to rationalize my behavior and my choices that I did towards her. And sometimes that happens a lot, because when you do apologize for something, people will kind of come and defend and actually justify your behavior. The reality is, there is no way that you can justify, there is no reason you can justify not treating somebody with respect. You read what was here in 1 John about loving your brothers. And we're not talking brothers and sisters in Christ, although they are inclusive in there. How we treat others. And if you repeatedly, and it talks about the accountability, if a person never treats anybody with respect, claims to be saved, and yet they never treat anybody with love, it's not for me to judge whether they're saved or lost. But John is clearly sending the message here, as he was inspired by God to do so, is to question that person, because our fruit, how we treat others, is a good reflection of what's in our heart and how we're treating others and how we feel towards others.
And he makes a point that that's the source of where that comes from.
Exactly.
And so, you know, it's not an all-inclusive statement he's making, but the point is that, you know, if you can't love your brethren with the love of God in your heart, we have to look at the source. And he uses the word eternal life.
Because that love that was extended to us
was a love that gave up his life on our behalf. So, how important is it to treat others? How do you feel you're doing on this particular commandment, the sixth one? You know, when I listened to this lesson, and as I thought about it and I studied, you know, I probably was at the beginning place of saying, okay, that one I'm pretty good with. But as I reflect upon it, this particular one is probably the one that I'm probably maybe not the most guilty of, because I'm guilty of all 10 of them. But this one probably has a higher incidence that I was willing to give myself credit for.
When you frame it from the standpoint, from the Old Testament and how they interpreted it, that it was an action issue, and then you understand Jesus' point is that it's a heart issue. You know, when you look at it, it's easy to say, I would never do that one, as he said, I don't even have to consider this one. But when you frame it from the standpoint that it's not an action, that it's a heart, that all actions flow from our heart, that it's probably the hardest. And not only the one that I probably, and sometimes not even consciously. Sometimes it's easy to say things and not be aware of the hurt that you're causing. You know, I have had a situation like you where I wasn't even the one talking. I was the one listening. And somebody overheard a conversation that someone else was having with me. And I didn't disagree with the person, and they were character assassinated. And so I was lumped in, and, you know, I wasn't even actively participating, but because I allowed that person and didn't come to the defense, I really was actively participating.
When we keep people from the love of God, we look at Cain and Abel. I mean, Abel's testimony was cut short, and what he could have given to those around him was wiped out. And Cain's descendants struggled with sin, something horrible. And we, when we don't show God's love, I mean, if they're seeing Christ through us, they're, you know, putting that wall up.
And going back to that, where does that start? Does it start with co-workers?
Mm-hmm.
It starts with your closest people.
That's right.
And
it's relationships. It's really hard to take it back when you say something to your spouse that's hurtful. When you say something to your kids. What with your kids?
Kids watching.
Absolutely. When they see how we may characterize behind closed doors others in our lives, these things have lasting impact. They don't see us, and we oftentimes behind closed doors in our families, we take a lot of liberty in terms of what we say, not fully comprehending what we've done. The last thing I want to say is that about children, train a child up in the way that you go, in the end you will not depart. I think oftentimes we look at that scripture and we always want to apply it to the example we get for them to be a Christian, what it means to be a Christian and to be saved. And frankly, that's the proper interpretation. But the other principle that's really underlying there is that train up a child in the way they should go. Train a child up consistently, no matter where you do. That's the way they're going to go. That's the direction they're going to go. Don't underestimate. That verse says the example you set for them is the example that they are going to follow. Now, there's always exceptions that you want to look at, but in general, that's a true statement. So, you know, words matter, and taking accountability for our words, because we think words are something you can't touch and feel. Words matter, and they set a tone, and they are just as powerful. And in these particular cases, being consumed by guilt, Christ is giving us the formula for how for us not to consume ourselves in guilt, and it's to love one another, as Christ loved us. Any last comments? Thanks, everybody.